Husbands Talking More or Less is brought to you by the Cage Club Network for all things media, movies, music, comics, and more. Check out the Cage Club Network. That's cageclub.me. Hey everybody, welcome back to HTML. I'm Nico.
I'm Kevo.
And I'm Joey.
And we're here to keep talking about the Dark Phoenix saga. Now, I want to give you guys a little green room magic. We are literally hitting record just a few minutes since we last recorded. This is all one big session. And since then, there has been major news! They have released the first images from Loki for Disney Plus.
Oh, it's taking place in the 70s, right? Is that right?
I believe it involves some amount of time travel, and evidently there is some WandaVision stuff going around, and there's just a lot going on with what's going to be one of our big, big focuses going forward. These amazing Disney Plus shows that we are so psyched for, they look to be giving us the kinds of things that I've been looking for, these smaller moments that I'm constantly begging for, so I am so thrilled.
It's what I've really wanted from Marvel Television and been disappointed that we haven't gotten, so it's going to be pretty exciting.
Now, Joey, I know that, you know, you're a movies guy. I mean, you're also a TV guy, but you're a movies guy. For me, the best possible anything of this X-Men franchise is the TV show Legion. It is far and away the most incredible thing. Noah Hawley just crafted one of the most beautiful television programs I've ever seen in my life. And Dan Stevens' performance wrecks me. And Jean Smart transforms me. And Legion is nothing like the comics. So really, if you want to try something X-Men that doesn't have anything it's super connected to, just pick up Legion. Now, Joey, I know you watch Legion. Do you plan on watching the Disney Plus shows?
So more than just a movie or a TV guy, I am a media junkie, media addict. I think just like in U2, I sort of found my people in that, hey, that's a thing that I might like. I'm going to watch that. I'm going to give that a try.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm going to sort of take it on a show-by-show basis. I'm very excited for WandaVision. I am excited for Loki. I like certain things. I haven't been really following it too much because I feel like there's just so much of everything that I have to take shows one at a time. And so I haven't really looked too deeply into what the Disney Plus shows are going to be, but I will be subscribing, and I also will be watching. And I will be looking forward to the HTML episodes covering those seasons at some point down the year, years down the line.
When we're old men.
Yeah. And evidently we're going to be 8 years from 60 and looking great. So I guess to kick things back over to X-Men or whatever, where were we again? I was being curmudgeonly about this movie.
To pick up where we left off, and to fit in with the theme of another show on this network, High School Slumber Party, we left the X-Men at a raucous party at Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, which, again, it's one of those things in this movie where I'm not sure what to make of it. Because remember that Jean and Scott are supposed to be, like, 25, and they're just sort of partying and drinking with a bunch of, like, 16, 15-year-olds. Weird.
Ugh, we had a name for guys like that. Burnouts. Jean Grey, you're a big fucking burnout.
Well, and that's exactly what she does. While Raven and Hank are sort of debating whether or not they should just fuck off and leave Charles to his fame whoring, I guess, Jean has sort of a blipvert moment. And
you guys, she's having a phoenix attack! Everybody, quick, get her mouth guard! She's having a phoenix attack!
Someone call the nurse!
Like a Chansey comes up out of nowhere, because at this point they're doing anything they can to make this franchise work. A Chansey just comes in, Chansey! And Nurse Joy comes running up, and then Jean eats them.
You know, I do have to say, on a semi-serious critical note, there was one moment in this film that I genuinely appreciated where they talk about how the mental blocks placed by Xavier were destroyed by Jean's contact with the cosmic entity. And I think that's sort of something I was supposed to get from the Phoenix story before now, that Jean's powers fully manifesting was in conflict with those walls. But, like, for some reason, it didn't really click until the way McAvoy phrased it. I'm not saying they did it better, but there was something about the way that he described it that I was finally like, oh, I get it. The Phoenix is fucking with that. Okay.
Well, you know, Claremont loves this big, beautiful language, and he is such, like, I always felt like you could describe Claremont's language as painted.
Speaking as someone who had to slog through a lot of Captain Britain, I get that.
Yeah, yeah. Claremont loves beautiful, floral, powerful prose in his comics, and it occasionally made his dialogue thick to parse. And I believe he discusses and describes Jean's transformation into Phoenix as she's becoming a being of pure desire. And while that line also makes it in, they were able to say some things, maybe a little bit more on the head in a way that I also agree. Look, this movie is not without its merit. It's not just the great acting. There are parts of it that are a competently made film by a fine group of people. And I'm fine with that. But oh, man, like,
we're going to have to make a,
like, I mean, I swear to God, we're going to have a bigger sensor. It was like, we're going to have to make a bigger mutant boat.
Oh, my God, yeah.
We're just going to have to set the knob to 11. You see, we're just going to have to make Phoenix 11.
When Hank says that her powers are off the charts, and she says, what does that mean? And he says, we're going to need a more powerful conductor, scanner, robot thing. I don't know, because the technology in this film doesn't make any fucking sense either. One of the things that I complimented this franchise on so much for the last three films is what amazing period pieces they were. The 60s, the 70s, and the 80s were so well represented, and this in no way was a 90s period piece at all. And that actually pissed me off as someone who was enjoying that element of this franchise. But so, like, whatever machine he's using, he's gonna need a bigger one. Ope-de-dope, yuck.
Like, and, like, Joey, was that silly to you? like, because I know that, like, shit, like, mutants have power levels is, like, a thing from the comics, and I'm fine with it. It's, like, a dumb thing, but there's a thing called the Ohotmu, the official handbooks of the Marvel Universe, and the Ohotmus literally give people power ratings. I'm used to that. Did that make the movie seem silly at all?
I don't really know how to answer that question. I just sort of, with a lot of these things, I just kind of go in kind of, not just X-Men, but all sort of movies, just kind of going in expecting I'm going to encounter things that I don't have any foundation or basis for, and just sort of try as best I can to roll with the punches.
If you poke the phlebotinum too much, the entire thing is going to fall apart.
Exactly.
I'm glad that I'm glad the central theme of this movie review is we didn't think it was the worst thing, so I guess that makes it fine.
Well, that's, I think, why, and I don't think I said this in the first episode, but the reason I liked it as much as I did, which is to say it was okay, is because I was expecting to see the worst movie of the year. And I don't think that's that. I think if you're super close to the property, you might hate it. But I don't think on a lot of different levels, technically story-wise, acting-wise, narratively, whatever, it's not necessarily good, but I don't think it's really, really bad. And I think in this regard, I mean, the negative buzz certainly didn't help box office numbers. I think it's the worst X-Men opening in franchise history, so way to go out with a whimper there. But I think it helped me enjoy it for not being the worst movie I've ever seen, if that's any kind of consolation to the movie at all.
You make an excellent point there. I definitely felt very much the same way. I had been going into this, like I said, I turned to Nico and said at points that I was afraid that it was going to turn out that the villain was a bastardized version of the very important X-Men character Lalandra, and apparently it could have been, but it wasn't. And I had expected this film to be so much worse than it was, so I was pleasantly surprised by how not terrible of a film it was, but that really shouldn't be the metric that you're ruling a movie by.
I'm famously critical of things. I look at things from a very its parts and how they come together approach. I can't see this movie for anything but, in some ways, a movie that absolutely had a vendetta against women and hit them with just about every negative trope you could outside of force. I don't think at any point there was a really direct sexual attack parallel. And in that regard, congratulations, you avoided being the worst. So I know I have trouble separating things, but I do want to say, ultimately, all said and done, I do think it's better than Wolverine Origins, and I think it is better than The Last Stand. I think The Last Stand is actually borderline unwatchable. It's incredibly clunky, and it made more mistakes with the continuity of the characters, you know, Magneto being like, Mystique's not blue, bye bitch. Like, that was worse than anything in this movie.
That was something that you said to me when we walked out of this film, was the fact that Magneto's reaction to Raven's death is so significantly removed from the way that Magneto reacted when Mystique lost her abilities in X-Men The Last Stand. And I was at least glad for that. It made both of those characters so much more significant, and it made me root for them so much more, especially after having watched them for so many films be ambiguous in as far as whether they really were villains or if they were just anti-heroes or what to feel about them.
One other thing that I do want to... It's not exactly in line with what you were just saying, Kevo, but one thing that I think also separates me from the two of you in regards to this movie, in regards to expectations, is that I don't watch trailers. So I think that's another level of layer removed, and I think that sort of prevents disappointment, like not only in terms of the knowing what happens in the comics, knowing sort of what the emotional beats could be versus what they actually are. Aside from all that, I don't really have preconceived notions in terms of what is going to happen, what might happen, what is probably going to happen. I just try to go into as many movies as blind as I can, and I think, because I think that there's a danger to going into movies with too high expectations, because unless a movie is so good that it exceeds those expectations, which is very, very rare, I think that there's a very easy chance of being disappointed. And conversely, I think, you know, I was benefited from, like, having listened to your episode and sort of not necessarily looking away from the trailer for this, because I wasn't looking forward to it enough to, like, want to be pure and spoiler-free. So I think because I had heard such negative stuff about it and heard you guys being so trepidatious last week about feeling like it was a chore to go see this movie, I think the fact that that all happened in a weird way made things a little bit better. And I think if I had known more closely than, like, if I had grown up reading the Dark Phoenix comics and or the saga, and, you know, and had more of a history with it than hearing, you know, Nico and Jonah or Nico and Kevo or the three of you talk about it for the last couple months, I would have probably been more disappointed. But I think that just that removal in a few different ways from both the marketing push for the movie, but also the history with the comics, which I talked about last episode, kind of salvaged this a little bit.
Well, here's something that's really funny about all of that in as far as trailers being spoilery or setting specific expectations or giving you different expectations than perhaps you should have for a film. One of the things I said after coming out of this was it really basically was just a feature film version of the trailer. I don't think, apart from finding out who Jessica Chastain's character was and like who this other faction coming after the Phoenix was, I think the trailers all pretty much just walk you through what the entire plot of the entire film is. I think if you're in any way an X-Men fan, or if you were aware of the previous X-Men films, so you know how Jean Grey met her end in those, you're aware that Jean Grey is probably going to die at the end of this movie. And that's the only thing I think that they didn't give away in the trailer. But to go into the next sequence of the film that was relied on unbelievably heavily in the trailers, after Jean yells at Charles and a bunch of people about how they don't understand her problems and she's not a little girl anymore, and she finds out that her father is actually alive when she thought that he had been killed in the car accident that did kill her mother, she runs off to go confront him. Thoughts on this sequence, everyone?
Nico.
Okay. So, the only thing I want to get in and say before what you are clearly ramping up for with that tone, and I appreciate whatever is coming next, I actually found part of the sequence even confusing. I what from Charles's behavior did Jean not get that there was something bad waiting for her? She's unbelievably surprised that her father never came for her, and she seems to think that he was under the impression that Charles stole her. But nothing about what she learned from him seemed to indicate that, so her reaction even was really bizarre and set me in a really odd frame of mind, even as we entered the sequence.
So, honestly, I feel like anything I want to say negative about this scene, I've already said. This scene's treatment of women was abhorrent, and that Jean was just an angry little girl, and there was nothing, I mean, I hated anything that said hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned in this, because this is kind of the only way Jean is the scorned party, and I think a child accidentally manifesting an ability, like a child accidentally leading to a parent's death, yeah, that really fucks you up, but she's kind of being treated like a monster here, and she's not a monster. So much of this was manufactured in a way that portrayed Jean in a really unnecessarily ugly light for these, I'm not saying, like, you know, when a child kills someone by accident not knowing what they're doing, you know, let's shrug it off, but there are some really unattractive implications and some really unforgiving ugliness in this scene.
You know, to touch back on something briefly you said in the middle of that, I'm on board with all of that, but you said something about her behaving or being treated like a little girl. And I think one of the issues I have with this film, too, is I don't feel that there is any significant work done to really show that this is 9 years later for these characters. They don't look any older. Jean Grey is 25 years old here because it's 9 years later, but she looks and behaves identically to the previous film, and all of the new X-Men do, really. And so it's really hard to know how to treat this character or how to perceive the way that she's behaving because there was no effort made to show that passage of time, I feel.
So, Joey, I know you don't have any connection to the source material, and even, like, again, Jean witnessing Annie's death is not like a humongous, overwhelming thing that comes up every day. So the thing this is even kind of touching on in a partial way, it isn't even that major to Jean's story. How, I mean, because I know one of the things you said is that you felt that this movie was fine if cliche. Was the, like, you know, angry woman thing, like,
did it ring any bells? Did it set off any alarms?
I mean, it's not good. It's not a good thing. I also do want to note, like, I don't know if Nico has asked me a single question this episode that hasn't led to a groan or just a utter disappointment, betrayal of the movie to him. So I like that. I appreciate that. Thank you, Nico. Keep doing you.
I really want to be positive about it. I just, and like, the performances.
No, I get it, because, like, I want to like every movie. And that, I think, in a way, is sort of how Mike and I started this network, because the thesis statement, essentially, behind Cage Club was that the internet loves Cage because they hate Cage. Like, it's easy to make fun of Nicolas Cage. It's easy to point to his bad movies, to his bad investments, to the fact that he was in debt to the IRS, and just make fun of him for all that. And he and I were essentially like, no, there's more to it. Let's see what it is. Let's be able to prove to people through movies that he can do more than just yell, not the bees. And I think we did that. And then that's why we went to Keanu, because Keanu, similarly, is sort of mocked and condescending. So I think, even though now the internet is all Keanu everything, like, Keanu is, like, the god of the internet right now, and I'm here for it. I'm on board. The point of that story, the teal deer, as you like to say, is we look at movies that could be bad and try to find the good things in them. And I think that's the same thing here. Like, this is not a movie that I will buy, that I will want to watch again, that I will remember much of in 6 months, but I think the three of us are all trying to talk about things, be fair and objective and critical when needed, but also find things that actually we enjoy, because there's good stuff here. It's just, you know, framed within a movie where there is a woman who is, you know, hell hath no fury, like you were saying. I don't know that it set off alarm bells, if that was the phrase you used. I think it's just, you've seen this before. I think you've seen this kind of story. You've seen this
use of women.
Yeah, you see this, like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I almost forgot about this one. Captain Corelli's mandolin.
The best, how did you not tell me about that? The, you know, Holt's husband. Oh, boy.
Say that to my face.
What an episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine that was. But I think when what sort of frustrates me in a sense, and I don't know that this is necessarily fair criticism, but when you're telling a story in a world like the X-Men where things literally do not abide by the rules of man that we know, like people have powers, like there are superheroes, there are mutants, there are things that do not exist that cannot exist in real life. Like, I feel like you have the ability to tell a new kind of story or a new twist, and I feel like this didn't. It's just like, oh, she's a psychic, but it's the same thing you've seen. And I feel like that's what frustrates me. Not that every movie has to be wildly unique, but for a movie that is about a story that is as important as this one is to so many people, like Nico, like Jonah, like everyone who grew up reading comics, like Kevo, I don't get the sense that you're as passionate about all of this as Nico is, so I don't want to leave you out, but, you know, I just feel like you could and should do more, like you kind of owe it to, and I know it's hard to make a movie, I've never made a movie, but I know it's very hard to make a movie, but just be better.
And especially when there's such a wealth of material and information and canon to draw from. We've spoken on so many of the adaptations of the Dark Phoenix saga over the last few weeks, and there are ones that this did not reflect at all, that they themselves drew from concepts from the comics. And there are so many things that you could have done and could have built on and had to draw from. And what you chose to do was still pretty generic. There are great performances from the actors, but that's not reflective of the story. That's reflective of their talent to convey the script they were given. You could have done so much more with the story and really giving us insight to Jean's character. It just comes across that she basically, like, has radiation poisoning that's fucking up her mutation, and because her mutation has to do with brain stuff, her, like, brain is going kerflooey, and she just needs to, like, get this radiation out of her, probably. Like, I think that's how other people who have no back knowledge of any of this canon probably view the film. Like, I can't imagine, unfortunately, how I hadn't considered before doing the podcast how people who don't have this experience might have considered it. But that's probably what people thought, and that's in no way honoring the spirit of what the actual story is. And it would have been so much a better story if you'd drawn from things like that. Instead, people are just like, oh, Jean has radiation poisoning, so she skewered Raven, and now Raven's out of the movie, bye.
And her death is, like, poorly directed? It takes forever to see that she's been stabbed.
It's another one of those moments that I feel like you lingered on way too long, and considering this film is only 114 minutes, maybe it was even to pad the runtime.
Including credits.
Including credits, yeah, so it was probably actually more like 104 minutes in the end. So no wonder they had to do these really long, slow, lingering pans. Part of me wants to be annoyed that Raven's last words are telling Hank that she loves him, but, you know, we've watched these characters grow over this whole decade, and for them, 30 years, and because they are not just lovers, but friends, it was really important to me and something that I really enjoyed. What were your feelings on the conclusion of Mystique for this decade's iteration of X-Men? Anyone, honestly.
So, one of the things about Mystique that's really fascinating is Mystique isn't just a character who is vital and relevant to the comics. I actually believe that Mystique's inclusion in the films is unique and vital to the films. Mystique is a very complex villain who is occasionally a sort of good guy, though she's never really a good guy in the comics. But in the films, this Mystique is transformative. She is a completely different character, and she's a beautiful character, and she deserved to be more than the fridge death to push Magneto and Beast along. Because her death could have been anything. Her death represented Jean just going too far. Now, Jean could have gone too far any which way, but the only way to make Magneto and Beast willing to kill Jean was to have her kill Raven. So Raven's fridging infuriates me, because it did not further Jean's story in any unique way. It served exclusively to enrage two men, break one man, and in that regard, Mystique's death was absolutely a misogynistic, unfair way to say goodbye to a strong woman.
And, you know, the only thing that I could possibly think to say in defense of taking Raven off the board for this story is I don't know how much of the film Jennifer Lawrence was honestly willing to be in. As I mentioned last episode, and I think she's pretty public about, she does not enjoy the makeup that it takes. And frankly, if that was the reason that she had to be removed, find another way. I would rather Raven have looked human for 75% of her appearance in this film than have her be killed just to further Jean's story. Especially because another major piece, Quicksilver, is also removed at the same time and would have just as easily been motivation for Magneto to turn against Jean, and is, frankly, an audience favorite. If you were going to remove a man from the board anyway, why wasn't he the one to die? Why wasn't Raven mortally wounded, but in the infirmary for the rest of the film? It was such a specific choice.
Meanwhile, you've got her appear as Stryker and flash her eyes yellow. You could have done something like
that. I wonder if she was killed because maybe that was, you know, like you were saying, Kevo, that we don't know how much of the movie she actually wanted to do. Maybe part of her contract or part of her writer or whatever you want to call it for coming back was, I have to die. I'm not doing another one of these movies. Like, I don't want to be pulled in. Like, that. I don't know. That makes it sound petty, but maybe that's the case. Like, I don't want to be on the hook for another one of these. I will come back. Like, sort of like, spoilers for The Force Awakens, jump ahead 10 seconds. Like, when Harrison Ford's like, I'll come back if I die, right? Like, I'll do one more if I don't have to do more. And I feel like that might be the same thing here. Like, she might say, I will give you another 40 minutes of screen time as Mystique as long as I never have to do one of these again, because I want to do other creative endeavors in my acting career.
And on the one hand, you want to be considerate of that person's professional decisions and their desire to make sure that they won't be roped back into more performances. I get all of that, I really do, but it's important to look at the larger implications of choices that we make when it comes to what we do professionally as creatives. I know that there are a lot of things that Nico and I need to take a second look at constantly and make sure that we are not doing something like killing a major female character just to further another woman's story who is mostly driven by the men around her. If it was because Jennifer Lawrence did not want to do the entire film and or wanted to make sure she didn't have to come back for another one, this wasn't the best way to do it. There are other ways that these things can be done, and you really need to think about the message that you're sending, because at this point, there are only really three major named significant female characters for the rest of the film. The titular Dark Phoenix herself, Jessica Chastain's
is that, are we about an hour, almost an hour and a half into these two episodes, and that's the first time any of us have said Vuck?
Well, they barely said it in the fucking movie.
In the Vucking movie?
I feel
movie?
Like, I have no idea at what point in the story she was introduced. It doesn't mention her on the Wikipedia summary that I am going off of for our point by point. I think she was introduced earlier than this, but honestly, the bad guys in this are so insignificant. It must have been so easy to rewrite them from being Skrulls, to rewrite her from being Lalandra, because they are so generic that they might as well not have any names from the comics.
One of the things that I find frustrating is they are referencing roughly a 7 or 8 page story in which Vuck came to Earth to get vengeance on Jean. This is a whole comics thing, but it's like 7 pages ever.
And it's a dude, and the Dabari actually look like broccoli monsters. And I think that in some story that he was on for a page somewhere back in like the 60s, he had an image inducer. I don't think that he could shapeshift. I don't know. Such an insignificant figure in as far as the comics are. So to have this character be named, I believe only in the credits mostly, I don't remember her saying her name, but to have this character be named Vuck was weird, and I think that is going to be the word that I introduce into my vocabulary to make sure I don't say fuck around my nieces too much.
I admire that. I don't know that it's far enough from the source material to really help, but I applaud you.
It's fine. The only other significant female character in the rest of the film is Storm, who, while we all enjoy her performance and her portrayal, doesn't really contribute much to the story other than being a canon, honestly. Even Nightcrawler gets a significant emotional moment later that was not okay.
Yeah, you know, and I think part of what I really had trouble with is if this is a cosmic entity, and it's this great big powerful cosmic entity, I'm just not sure how Jessica Chastain can just, like, know so much about it and just, like, take it. But, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit. At this point, they decide to bring Magneto into the movie, and Jean heads out to Genosha. Genosha's lovely. I like Genosha here. It's nice, but I again think this scene is a little ridiculous. Magneto's like, you know, why are you here? And Jean's like, help me control my powers and hide me. And then the government comes looking for Jean because she blew up some cops during that whole Mystique fight, after which Vuk, like, so Vuk's powers seem to be shapeshift once and crush people's sternums to get information.
Yeah, and I think also somehow, like, have psychic powers to be able to find Jean and the cosmic entity. But yeah, pretty much. The Genosha sequence was fine for me. It was just, it was really fucking slow. And I don't think added enough to it emotionally that it justified taking as long as it did.
There was so much, go! Magneto sounded like me watching this movie.
Magneto is such a good guy in these movies, too. Can we talk about that for, like, just 1 second? Like, Magneto from the original trilogy just would not give a fuck about these humans. And in fact, he would probably revel in the fact that he can just blame them being killed on Jean. Oh, it's not Genosha's fault. But, like, he's actually a lot more, like, level-headed and cares about these people that he's built this home for. And wants to save humans so darn bad. Just does it differently than Charles does.
And that brings me to a really fascinating point. I just want to bring up that I'm attacking this movie for its hyper-fridging, but the X-Men franchise actually has a long history of the pivotal character death that forwards the film. In the first film, it's Senator Kelly. In the second film, it's Jean. In the third film, it's Charles. In First Class, it's all of the fucking students, but, you know, Darwin in that movie. In Days of Future Past, it's all the people, but they die off-screen, and then a bunch of people die in the future. In Apocalypse, they kill Havoc and Magneto's wife and daughter. And it's just, these movies have a long history of kill someone and that makes people act different. So, like, I'm not even comparing this to the source material, but I've already drawn parallels of inaccuracy between this and Apocalypse in terms of what exactly Jean's power set is and what the Phoenix is and what's cosmic, and the formulaic way these films keep doing the same thing. And I am left feeling really disappointed, because even the Genosha sequence could have been cool and ultimately just turned into another power off. And also, it is not her fault, but every time Jean flew away, I just kept thinking, Sophie Turner, you deserve better. Jean's flight power looked so dumb.
It's hard to make flying look cool in a movie. It's not as hard as some people make it be, but it's not easy either.
Okay, so, you know, I'm beyond perplexed, because I feel like when we started this project, I kind of assumed that the one we would have the least to say about would be this movie. I figured that because it would be an immediate reaction, short-term snapshot of an emotional response to a film that had been built up in this over-the-top sort of way in my mind, that I would have the least to say about it, because I'd have the least time with it or something. But to my incredible amazement, we are talking about this movie for longer than we talked about any other chunk of the franchise. By that, I mean the animated series in its entirety, the first three fucking movies, and the second three fucking movies. What is it about Dark Phoenix that has us chitter-chattering?
I think it's because it's the culmination of this project in so many ways, and it was the only unknown factor when we went into this, and there was so much hope and expectation, and because this is the culmination of 20 years of X-Men films, there's just so much to react about it.
Joey, we hadn't really gotten your response to any of the other films as we went, so I guess it's partially that This is your chance to finally weigh in and put the Joey stamp on it.
It's Joey's turn.
Oh boy. I wish I'd done my homework then, because I have not seen these movies in a long time. So here's a quick rundown. Don't really remember the original trilogy. Sorry. I think I mentioned hours ago. It feels like we've been talking about this movie for, what feels like weeks. I don't know. It feels like we've been here forever. I love First Class. I really like Days of Future Past. Hated Apocalypse. Thought this movie was okay. Not great, as I've been saying. In my head, you know, if I'm going to put one of these movies on, I would probably watch First Class again, and then probably Days of Future Past. I also bought the Rogue Cut, and I don't know if you guys talked about, did you talk about the difference between the regular cut and the Rogue Cut when you did that trilogy? I don't remember.
I have to be honest, we barely had an excuse to talk about that fucking movie.
That's what I thought, because I remember liking that movie, or like, not thinking it was as good as First Class, but I remember really liking that one a lot. So I'd probably watch those two, or maybe I would go back and watch the first two, the original two again. I don't know. I don't have anything against them. I feel like that's kind of my whole, you know, broken record stamp of approval of sorts on here, is that I don't dislike these movies. I just don't have a particular affinity toward them. So I think that's why I think maybe the first thing I said was that, like, I'm going to like these movies. You know, I'm never going to love them the way that you guys do, but I'm also never going to hate them the way that you guys do. And so I would love to go back and watch the original trilogy again, you know, Days of Future Past and First Class again. I never Apocalypse, probably not this movie. But yeah, I think that's sort of all I have to say about that. Eventually, I will watch them again. But I also want to rewatch, you know, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. And I'd rather, you know, I want to rewatch again, probably the, you know, the Michael Keaton Batman movies. There's so many that I've seen once that I want to, you know, re-up on it, I guess.
And I personally cannot wait to revisit this franchise here on HTML, because there's so many layers to this X-Men franchise that we barely had a chance to touch on. For instance, not a lot of fans may realize that there is a direct connection between the Fantastic Four and the X-Men in the form of the villain Apocalypse. It's a big story, and it involves a lot of appropriative, offensive Egyptian stuff, but provided they can figure out how to get their shit together and get the sensitivity reader on it, they could have told that story. In fact, there was every intention of having Mark Millar of Kick-Ass fame come in and piece this together for people. So we almost got a Fantastic Four X-Men universe that was connected, except Josh Trank's Fantastic Four was fuck-tast-foul.
Fan-four-stick.
Fan-four-stick. Well, until we have an excuse to come back here and discuss more about these amazing movies and finish this one for whatever the hell reason, Joey, where can everybody find you?
You can find me at cageclub.me/Joey every other Tuesday. I do Too Fast, Too Forever with Joe 2, going through the Fast and Furious movies on repeat forever. And then every Friday, alternating Fridays, Mike and I talk about Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks movies, one week, one the next week. So go check those out. I've got other shows that are coming out here and there, but those are the two big ones. cageclub.me/Joey to find everything you'd ever want to know and some stuff you don't about me.
Phenoms. Excuse me, Mr. H, H of the HTML. Wonderful husband, Kevo. Where can everybody find you on the internet other than always with me?
I was like, who's H? What are you talking about? You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Kevo Really, KevoReally, or you can find me on the Facebook page for this lovely show, Husbands Talking More or Less, at Official HTML. You can also find my artwork, along with that of the rest of the Demon Hotel team, at Kid Ride Comics on Facebook and KidRideComics.com. Where can everyone find you, Nico?
You can find me here on this here amazing network doing all sorts of stuff, like talking about the way I love pop music with my childhood best friend, Chris Podcasts, over on Now That's What I Call Music. No, over on Now and Again, where we talk about That's What I Call Music. We've kind of deviated a little bit from the narrative purpose of the show, and we've taken a beautiful detour through Carly Rae Jepsen's discography, and it has been quite a fun project, but I am excited to get back to the nows. We've also been doing an amazing show called X's for Podcasts, where we talk about all sorts of amazing X-Men things. Currently, we're making our way through the 1980s mutant expansion, bringing on all sorts of new guest hosts like Dylan Warpath and Amanda Martini. You don't want to miss it. As well as on my Instagram over at Nico Action, that's NicoAction. Okay, so I guess we got to do one more fucking part of this movie. I just can't until we're back here again. Jesus Christ.
I'm not doing that bird noise again.
And can I just get a see ya?
You guys there? Did I lose you?
Yeah. Can I get a goodbye noise from you?
Yes! Yes!
Son of a